and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Ken Vogel, a reporter with the New York Times Washington Bureau, who joins us to discuss his latest article, Advising Bolton is a Shadow NSC. We'll look into the role of a group of neocon activists and lobbyists close to the new National Security Advisor, John Bolton, which means that now, with like-minded neocons dominating the NSC, there will be no diversity of opinion or dissenting views presented to Trump. With both North and South Korea blaming Bolton for the shaky ground that the summit between Trump and Kim Jong-un is now on because Bolton tied the upcoming talks to the Libya model, which Kim interprets as regime change by a mob tearing a dictator apart, it looks like the tail of the neocon is wagging the big dog in the Oval Office. Then we'll get an analysis of the Supreme Court's 5-4 decision led by Trump's new Justice Neil Gorsuch, which kills off a vestige of the 1935 New Deal in terms of workers' rights, doing away with class action suits to redress issues such as wage theft and forcing employees into arbitration, which is heavily weighted in favor of employers over employees. Celine McNicholas, the Economic Policy Institute's Labor Council and a core member of their Perkins Project on Workers' Rights and Wages, joins us to discuss the court's corporatist tilt and today's stinging dissent by Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Then we'll examine the Secretary of Treasury's announcement, quote, "We're putting the trade war on hold after the completion of talks with Chinese negotiators in what looks like a win for China, since they appear to have given up little in return for the U.S. holding off on imposing tariffs of $150 billion on Chinese imports." Catherine Russ, a professor of economics at the University of California, Davis, who worked for the Obama administration's Council of Economic Advisers, a senior economist for international trade and finance, joins us to discuss whether the self-proclaimed ultimate dealmaker, Donald Trump, has been smoked by Xi Jinping. Given the recent case of a Chinese bank investing in a Trump-related Indonesian deal, which appears to be a quid pro quo to get the Chinese telecom giant ZTE off the hook, we will assess whether calling Trump's bluff with money is an advantage the Chinese and others can exploit if Trump can be bribed with financial deals that enrich him at the expense of our economy and U.S. national security. With Jared Kushner having already shown that a bad investment by the Kushner Company in 666 Fifth Avenue can be rescued by the Trump administration using instruments of statecraft against Qatar to get them to pay to have a blockade lifted, then how can we be confident that the Trump family business does not take priority over our economic and foreign policy? Joining us now is Ken Vogel, a reporter with the New York Times' Washington Bureau, where he covers the confluence of money, politics, and influence. He's the author of Big Money, $2.4 billion, One Suspicious Vehicle and a Pimp, On the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking of American Politics. And his latest article at the New York Times is Advising Bolton is a Shadow NSC. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ken Vogel.
Hey, great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Ken. And it looks as if – do you think that Bolton deliberately sort of sabotaged the North Korean deal by – talking about the Libya model, which, of course, Donald Trump had to sort of revise. Obviously, it was a huge flag to the North Koreans who interpreted the Libya model in terms of their nuclear disarmament as meaning that Kim Jong-un would end up like Gaddafi. So there's a possibility that he was talking about the Libya model in terms of nuclear disarmament as opposed to the fate of Gaddafi and therefore Kim. But was that a slip of the tongue or deliberate slip of the tongue? What do you think?
Well, I mean, whatever Bolton meant here, both on the context of it and in terms of the history, it's pretty clear where he is on these types of things. He does not want to engage. He has a very well established track record of taking aggressive stances towards geopolitical foes, real and perceived, in this case, obviously a real one, and he's been skeptical of engagement, and he's let that be known, and that is one way in which, at least in the case of North Korea, he is not, he does not have a position that is consistent with that of the Trump administration and with Donald Trump in particular. So, he is going to be, the influence that he's going to have over Trump, it's hard to imagine it being anything different than the stances that he's taken over the years, which are a much more hawkish, confrontational type of engagement, if any engagement, with some of these countries around the world.
Well, there's no question that the atmosphere, at least about these talks, has changed. There's some uncertainty. Even Trump himself is now apparently expressing some uncertainty that they will take place. And it would seem, well, the North Koreans saying that they find Bolton repugnant. I won't give you the whole quote, but it was pretty strong language. So it is pretty much in limbo now, isn't it? So whatever the intention was in terms of bringing up the Libya model, ever since then, the idea of Donald Trump collecting his Nobel Peace Prize has been somewhat in doubt, right. Has it not?
Yeah, well, I mean, you have to think that, you know, Bolton or not, I mean, certainly Bolton does add this voice, and a very prominent and loud voice, and one that is very influential with the president, so it seems. And the president has this history of sort of gravitating to and granting access to his newest advisor. He has this sort of bright, shiny object syndrome when it comes to these new White House aides, and Bolton is that at the moment. And so I don't want to downplay in any way the type of influence that he might be having over Donald Trump's thinking or that of the administration when it comes to the North Korea talks. That said, you have to think that this skepticism towards North Korea and talk about preconditions would be going on in the background, regardless of who was national security advisor or who was in any of these given positions. It's certainly a reasonable sort of skepticism to have, and is one that has guided U.S. foreign policy in the past. So the real question here is to what degree, you know, Bolton is exerting influence, and to what degree Bolton is bringing in some of these traditional voices that might offset that, you know, the not traditional voices, but voices who might be in favor of more engagement with North Korea, with Iran, or whether he is sort of shutting out dissenting voices, or voices that are dissenting to his, at least, when it comes to this type of engagement. And that's why the story that we wrote about the types of people who Bolton has brought in from his career in neoconservative politics was of interest to us, because the role of the NSC has always been to bring in all these diverse viewpoints from across the government and across the academy and distill them and present, you know, synthesize them into a set of options that really give you the broadest sweep of the approaches that the U.S. president might take. And Bolton instead has brought in a very sort of sycophantic crew of longtime advisors who have views that are very similar to his own.
And he's also either done some purging or people have voluntarily left. Any prominent people that you could name? Is Fiona Hill still there on the Russia desk?
I'm not sure. I don't think so. I mean, he's definitely, there was an exodus, and his people say, well, this was actually people who wanted to leave on their own, and he didn't have anything to do with it. My sources tell me otherwise. You know, there are whole offices that have been shuttered, including the cyber security office. Tom Bossert was either left or pushed out, depending on who you talk to. So, you know, to some extent, some turnover is to be expected when you have an incoming regime. The difference here is that this is the third national security advisor that we've seen in less than 16 months in the Trump administration. Of course, Michael Flynn was the first, didn't last very long under the cloud of the Russia inquiry and having lied to Mike Pence, the vice president, about his contacts, about Flynn's contacts with the Russian ambassador, replaced by H.R. McMaster, who was seen as a globalist in the coinage of Steve Bannon and the more nationalist wing of the Trump base, and now replaced by someone who is more, and frankly, you know, Bolton is more of a traditional neoconservative Republican hawk. Flynn and McMaster, in different ways, were sort of anathema to the traditional Republican foreign policy orthodoxy, and Bolton is a little closer to that, although, you know, arguably he is tends toward the more confrontational approach in a way that his critics have cast as extremist.
And again, I'm speaking with Ken Bogle, a reporter with the New York Times Washington Bureau, whose latest article in the New York Times is Advising Bolton is a Shadow NSC. And you mentioned Tom Bossert being pushed out of the National Security Council, the Homeland Security Advisor. His deputy, Rob Joyce, just gave notice that he's leaving as well. So, but the most influential advisor that you mentioned of the Boltons that you mention in your article at the New York Times, Ken Vogel, advising Bolton is a shadow NSC, is Matthew Friedman. And he appears to be sort of muddying the water of being both a consultant and running his business, a consultant to the National Security Council at the same time running his business that effectively has business with the government, particularly in terms of national security. And he, of course, has a background as being a foreign lobbyist working with Paul Manafort doing the bidding of the Philippines dictator Ferdinand Marcos. So the more prominent, though, neocon is David Wormser, right? I mean, he's just absolutely neocon central, right?
Yeah, that's right. He is more out of the traditional sort of neoconservative school of foreign policy thought. He was an advisor on the Middle East to Vice President Dick Cheney, seen as a big cheerleader for the invasion of Iraq. Although it should be said that he, too, in recent years, as all these neoconservatives have kind of been in exile, both obviously during the Obama administration, but even at the beginning of the Trump administration, where it wasn't quite the same usual cast of characters, these folks were on the outs, and many of them, including Wormser, went into private practice. Wormser had a firm that advised companies and countries around the world on natural gas exploration in the Middle East. John Bolton himself was listed on that company's website as an advisor to David Wormser's company as recently as last week. They changed the website and pulled Bolton off of it when I started asking questions about it. But it just goes to show these sort of two dynamics that are in play here. One, Bolton bringing in folks who were out of that neoconservative, cut from that neoconservative cloth, and who are going to potentially give him advice that is more aggressive and confrontational than certainly what we saw under H.R. McMaster or during the Obama administration. And number two, this sort of merger, this blurring of the line between private sector, consulting, or what is euphemistically called private sector diplomacy, with the actual affairs of conducting the United States government's foreign policy. That blurring of the line has created a lot of unease among government watchdogs, as well as people in and around the Trump NSC, let alone the broader national security apparatus, who say that it is extremely unusual to be bringing in these types of people. Not even to be bringing them in. I mean, certainly someone can leave private practice and come into the government, but to be simultaneously having a firm that does this type of business while either informally advising the federal government on national security and foreign policy in a way that overlaps with your business, or to be working as a, quote, special government employee, which is a particular type of employment status that allows people to maintain private sector business outside employment while advising the government, sometimes paid, sometimes for free. But even if it's paid, or, certainly it's for free, and even if it's paid, the amount of potential marketing value and the amount of sort of boost that having such a position inside the government, informal or otherwise, can provide to your business. In other words, the amount that it appeals to potential clients who might be interested in getting connections to the U.S. government is really tremendous, and that's something that does bother ethics watchdogs.
And as your article in the New York Times points out, Ken Vogel, it's ethically a fraught to have consultants who do business with the government moonlighting as advisors to Mr. Bolton, according to Walter Shubb, who resigned as the head of the Office of Government Ethics. But surely further up the chain towards Donald Trump, his own son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has apparently broken new ground in the sort of blurring of the lines between national security, foreign policy, and personal enrichment. There have been any number of reports that him and his father tried to shake down the Qataris for $500 million to rescue a bad investment known as 666 Fifth Avenue. The Qataris told him to go to hell, and then shortly thereafter, the Saudis blockaded Qatar, and that has been very difficult for them, obviously. But now we learn that suddenly the Qataris have had a change of mind, and they've decided to put in $500 million into 666 Fifth Avenue to rescue the Kushner Company. And I think it's pretty likely that the blockade of Qatar is going to be lifted soon.
Yeah, I mean, that's right, and that's an apt analogy. And this sort of blurring of the lines of this concern about how private business might influence the affairs of the U.S. government is not just in one agency, but it's really throughout the administration during Donald Trump's presidency, and that's a tone that is set, I think, from the top. It's you know, we've never had a president who has had so many business entanglements himself or among his immediate inner circle, in this case his family, Jared Kushner, of course, being his son-in-law, and that is an ongoing area of concern, and it is unprecedented. You mentioned Walter Schaub at the Office of Government Ethics. He actually resigned as a result of, or at least he says, as a result of having raised these concerns repeatedly and urged various safeguards that were ignored or not implemented. And so this is yet another facet of this same dynamic.
Well, just in closing, John Bolton, of course, before he came into the White House as the third National Security Advisor, he had been raising money from a lot of people, many of whom were close to the Trump campaign, Robert Mercer being, I think, the second biggest donor to the campaign. He put $5 million into Bolton's operation. And, of course, Sheldon Adelson is not just the biggest donor to the Trump campaign. He also apparently was the biggest cheerleader for Bolton getting the job. And obviously he carries some weight with Trump and with Netanyahu. And the day after Trump killed the Iran deal, Adelson attended a private meeting at the White House with the president, Vice President Mike Pence, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, and John Bolton. Do you think they were celebrating? I mean, what else were they doing?
I'm sure they were celebrating, although it's important to note here, Ian, that the folks who are familiar with that meeting say that it had long been on the books and was unrelated to the Iran deal. But there is no doubt that Sheldon Adelson was more than a cheerleader. He was an influential voice in President Trump's ear and the ears of those around him on these two major foreign policy shifts in the Middle East that both came in rapid succession after John Bolton was named, although they were certainly in the works for much longer, those being the move of the U.S. Embassy in Israel to Jerusalem and also with the United States withdrawal from the Iran deal. Those are both seen as huge victories for neocons and for Sheldon Adelson and for John Bolton. They've been pushing for these things for years. Donald Trump promised them during the campaign, but there was some question as to whether he would buck the wisdom of the sort of national security establishment, foreign policy establishment that said that both these moves would potentially have dire consequences. He sure enough did buck that conventional wisdom, and I think, you know, certainly we saw some immediate protests in Israel in response to this and throughout the Arab world, but on the Iran deal, the verdict is not yet in. So we'll see how this stuff plays out. Certainly having John Bolton by his side and in his ear will ensure that Donald Trump is hearing from supporters of these moves, who will be urging him to hold the course. And as to whether he will be getting dissenting information with the NSC shaping up as it is in his image, that's less certain.
No, it doesn't look like there's a lot of diversity there. And that groupthink is a hugely problematic thing when it comes to decisions of state, particularly those involving national security. And I thank you for joining us, Ken Vogel.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Ken Vogel. He's a reporter for the New York Times Washington Bureau, where he covers the confluence of money, politics, and influence. He's the author of Big Money, $2.5 Billion, One Suspicious Vehicle, and a Pimp, On the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking of American Politics. And his latest article at the New York Times is Advising Bolton is a Shadow NSC. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an analysis of the Supreme Court's 5-4 decision led by Trump's new Justice Neil Gorsuch, which kills off a vestige of the 1935 New Deal in terms of workers' rights.
Come, you masters of war, ye that build the big guns, ye that build the death planes, ye that build all the bombs, ye that hide behind walls, ye that hide behind discs. I just don't want you.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working. here no more. A woman done left, took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it, I ain't working here no more.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining me now is Celine McNicholas, the Economic Policy Institute's Labor Council and a core member of their Perkins Project on Worker Rights and Wages, a policy response team that tracks the Trump administration's wage and employment policies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Celine McNicholas.
Thanks for having me.
And the Supreme Court ruling today, which was written, the majority opinion was written by Neil Gorsuch, the newest member of the court. He was suspected of being a corporatist. He actually auditioned for the Supreme Court, in effect, in the infamous truck driver, frozen truck driver situation where a trucker's rig had broken down in a blizzard and he had the choice between freezing to death or seeking help and abandoning the rig. And Gorsuch made a name for himself amongst the Federalist Society by ruling that the truck driver, in fact, should have stayed there and frozen to death. And that, it seems to be borne out in this ruling. This is so tilted in favor of the employer over the employee.
Yes, I certainly think that this is Exhibit A for workers on the difference between Gorsuch and a court that would have been constituted with President Obama's nominee Merrick Garland on the bench.
And I think it was made clear, was it not, by the dissent. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I don't think she's written a more forceful and impassioned rebuke, has she not?
Yes, no, this was a very powerful dissent, longer than the majority holding, which in and of itself is something novel. But absolutely, I think that the dissent was powerful and speaks to the potential impact of this majority opinion.
So would you mind, just for our audience, giving us a brief summary of Gorsuch's peculiar interpretation of the National Labor Relations Act, which he shredded, a vestige of the New Deal, written in 1935, and also Ruth Bader Ginsburg's dissent?
Sure. So the National Labor Relations Act gives workers in this country the ability to join together to essentially better their working conditions, whether that's through formal, you know, labor organizing in a traditional union model, or that's through protected concerted activity that occurs outside of that sort of traditional collective bargaining model. And Justice Gorsuch sort of puts a hierarchy, I would say, of what collective action looks like for working people in this country. He gives a certain preference to that which is done in the context of a traditional labor organization, and then sort of says there's nothing in the act itself that would confer any kind of additional right to collective action for working people. And Justice Ginsburg in her dissent sort of makes the point that the courts and certainly the National Labor Relations Board have had traditionally a more expansive interpretation of what the National Labor Relations Act confers on working people in this country. But I will just say one thing. I think that there's going to be a great deal of reading and parsing these opinions. But, you know, while there's absolutely a narrowing in the majority opinion in terms of what the National Labor Relations Act does to protect workers' joint action, I would say that it is an open question about whether or not that narrow interpretation will occur in cases where you're not having a statute that's in conflict with another statute. And that's sort of what happened here, the Federal Arbitration Act versus the National Labor Relations Act. And when you're reading between, you know, two statutes that are in conflict, the court tends to narrow the reading of both. And here, as Justice Ginsburg stated at the beginning of her dissent, it's clear that the majority subordinated the National Labor Relations Act and the work that the Act protects to the Federal Arbitration Act. And that's sort of the crux of what happened. The FAA came out on top of the NLRA today.
And again, I'm speaking with Celine McNicholas, who's the Economic Policy Institute's Labour Council and a core member of their Perkins Project on Workers' Rights and Wages, a policy response team that tracks the Trump administration's wage and employment policies. And we're talking about the Supreme Court's ruling in a 5-4 decision on Monday in Epic Systems versus Lewis. The workers at Epic Systems basically are suing under what they consider to be wage theft. And since they all found out they were being screwed, they all got together and did a class action suit on behalf of themselves. And that's exactly what's been thrown out. And the new rules of the road mean that you're forced to go to arbitration, which, by the way, I believe lots of corporations force people to sign that agreement on entering the workplace in the first place. But those that don't now, I assume, are bound by the Supreme Court. And it's well established that if you go into arbitration, the outcome strongly favors the employer over the employee.
Yes, there's been a number of studies that show that workers fare less well in arbitration than they do when they file suits in the court system. And it makes a lot of sense because, you know, arbitration is essentially, a pay-to-play, situation. So the employer is going to be the repeat customer, and that's something that absolutely factors into the way arbitration works for working people.
So in other words, in arbitration, the arbitrator, whether it's a retired judge or a lawyer, that person's paid by the employer, not the plaintiff.
Yeah, there's different ways that arbitration can occur, and sometimes the cost is shared between parties. So, for example, when you have the traditional collective bargaining agreement would involve some sort of an arbitration process and procedure to handle grievances, and you may have an independent arbitrator who's involved in that process. And there's a cost sharing that's worked out between the union and the employer. In the traditional waiver of, class and collective actions and waiver of, the right to go to court, which is what you see in these mandatory or forced arbitration agreements, it's often the employer who retains sort of complete control of the process and ultimately foots the bill for that process.
And he who pays the piper, right?
That's right.
So what's your sense then of a recourse, given that, as I say, this is a blow against possibly one of the last vestiges of New Deal labor law going back to 1935. And this is, a lot of political scientists and sociologists have suggested that the United States is moving inexorably towards a plutocracy away from democracy. And this would seem to be a step in that direction in that broader context. What can be done? The Congress can reverse this or fix this, can they not?
Yes, absolutely. Congress could enact legislation that would sort of restore the fundamental right of workers to join together, whether through a formal legal action or informally, going to the boss to ask for a higher wage rate or to turn the heat on in a plant, whatever that request may be. There's absolutely a way that Congress can and should respond, and you saw that in Justice Ginsburg's dissent, where she sort of calls on Congress to take action to correct the majority opinion.
So given that the swing states that elected Trump narrowly by 77,000 votes, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, do have a lot of industrial workers, is there a way for this ruling to get the attention of those that voted arguably against their interests in favor of Donald Trump? Because if there is a change in the House in the November elections and they try and fix this legislatively, Trump's not going to sign it, is he?
Yeah, I would certainly assume that President Trump would not be supportive of a fix on this. This is his Supreme Court, in the sense that Gorsuch, his nominee, is the author of the majority opinion. I can't see him being supportive of something like that. But I would just say that this, really does stand to have widespread implications for working people in this country, and really for what employment looks like for all of us. Because if these sort of hard-fought, hard-won employment protections actions can simply be required to be waived as a condition of employment on our first day on the job. You know, you could make the argument that it would be a lot more honest to just have Congress repeal all of those protections and return to a time when it was sort of workers free to engage in self-help. And, you know, you'd see a lot more labor instability in instances like that. And I think you're already sort of seeing that creep with some of the teacher strikes where you take rights away from folks so that there's no way that they can kind of get any kind of workplace justice. I think that this is just another step in that direction, but it certainly goes beyond, you know, just pure collective union, you know, action. This is about how workers access a whole host of rights.
So I've always been struck in these confirmation hearings for Supreme Court justices how little, of course, we know that they're all about avoiding answering questions rather than giving you insight into how the nominee thinks and how they might rule. But nevertheless, I've never recalled any questions focused on whether or not the justice is a corporatist. And my sense would be that since so many, if you look at the law writ large, there are lots of corporate lawyers, there are criminal lawyers, I guess, and there are public interest lawyers. But it would seem to me that the Supreme Court, particularly on the conservative side, is dominated by former corporate lawyers who arguably have a bias in favor of corporations. Is there anybody on the Supreme Court that comes out of public interest law?
Certainly not that has been nominated in recent memory. But, you know, I would say that I think all of this works in, obviously, there's a system of balances here across our government. And, you know, how did we get here? You know, we got here because there, you know, this employer tactic kind of crept up, this requiring workers to sign away their rights as a condition of employment. I think if there's one thing that jumped out at me at today's opinion that I just think the majority gets completely wrong, it is that sort of summary of how we got here, this notion that, you know, something changed in the atmosphere, that you had an activist agency that sort of decided to look at a statute different than it had ever looked at it before, when in reality employers sort of discovered a new way of frustrating workers' ability to access their rights and then started to, you know, mandate that. And you saw the practice grow and then litigation crept up around it. And I think, you know, if there's one thing I will say of how we got here, it's really political neglect in so many ways of just kind of keeping up worker protections with what goes on in the workplace. I think that that's, you know, not just something that we can blame on the court.
So back to my question about electoral impact, is this likely to be a campaign issue? I mean, I don't know that the Democrats have a coherent message at this point, but surely this would be a message that they could use, couldn't they? I mean,
I think as we discussed earlier, the impact of this, you know, it cuts across just about every worker protection that we have on the job. We could be forced to sort of go to individual arbitration in order to, you know, access that right. And I think that's something that really would change the way the nature of the employment relationship in this country. And so absolutely do I think that how to message that best, I think people will actually begin experiencing this sooner rather than later. And it's one of those things that I think it's sort of been creeping up, and there's always been sort of a legal uncertainty here. That legal uncertainty no longer exists, which means that employers, and you see this already with, you know, some management firms sort of putting out bulletins advising clients to immediately sort of adopt these mandatory arbitration with class and collective action waivers. You know, you're going to see this happen more and more, and unfortunately, you know, workers may not understand off the bat what you're signing when you're signing your whole host of, you know, employer paperwork when you're onboarded by your employer. But I think when you run into an issue at work, whatever that issue looks like, whether it's you're, you know, experiencing sexual harassment on the job, whether you are like the folks who were plaintiffs in the vast majority of the cases that were consolidated today, were not paid overtime that they were rightfully entitled to under the law, whatever the specific workplace grievance is, you're going to have a harder time you know, being able to advance your own solution to that, because you're going to have to go it alone. You're going to have to be in an arbitration system that disfavors the worker, and even more the individual worker. You know, that's going to be something that is just a high bar, and that's why you see employers being willing to spend a great deal of money to get a verdict like today, sort of clearing the way for them to require this of their workforce.
Well, just in closing, a former employee of Murphy Oil, Sheila Hobson, she brought a case forward that she was basically ripped off, required to do off-the-clock work, which they weren't compensated for. She sued the Obama administration under the National Labor Relations Board. They agreed with her and filed a brief with the Supreme Court in support of Hobson. But as soon as Trump was inaugurated, his administration took the unusual step of reversing the Obama administration's position on a case before the court. So they really have shown their hand, have they not?
Yes, and I do believe that having sort of the split within the government's own argument, so you had a solicitor general, you know, making a different argument than you did the federal agency that was tasked with enforcing the National Labor Relations Act, I absolutely think that that played a role in the court reaching the conclusion that it reached today. So that was unhelpful, and nothing changed in terms of the legal landscape. So the only reason that the Trump administration made that decision was a purely political one to side with the employers over working people in the case.
And that's, just in closing, that of course is Ruth Bader Ginsburg's argument. She said the majority is substituting its prefer, meaning the majority, meaning Gorsuch, is substituting his preferred economic policies for those chosen by the people's representatives. Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today. Celine McNicholas.
No problem, my pleasure.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Celine McNicholas, who's the Economic Policy Institute's Labor Council and a core member of their Perkins Project on workers' rights and wages, a policy response team that tracks the Trump administration's wage and employment policies. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with Ken Vogel, a reporter with the New York Times Washington Bureau, about his latest article, Advising Bolton is a Shadow NSC. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Catherine Russ, who's a professor of economics at the University of California, Davis, who worked for the Obama administration's Council of Economic Advisers as senior economist for international trade and finance. She is a faculty research associate in the National Bureau of Economic Research, International Trade and Investment Group, and a research advisor to the Halle Institute for Economic Research in Halle, Germany. And she has been a visiting scholar at the Central Banks of Germany, Portugal, and France, and the Federal Reserve Banks of St. Louis and San Francisco. Welcome to Background Briefing, Catherine Russ.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And with the Secretary of the Treasury announcing after a weekend of negotiations with Chinese trade negotiators, quote, we're putting the trade war on hold. It looks as though the Chinese negotiators have, it looks like a win for them, frankly, because they appear to have given up little in return for the U.S. holding off on imposing tariffs of $150 million on Chinese exports. How do you see it?
So to the degree that this joint communique, these negotiations have led to immediate relief for agricultural sector goods from the U.S. piling up at Chinese ports due to increased inspections, these kinds of things, then I think, you know, something has been achieved. In the longer term, it is hard to tell exactly what impact this would have on U.S.-Chinese trade. I think there's a little bit of an issue with the negotiating objectives as stated, because they're focusing on trying to reduce the current account, which is largely driven by the trade balance. So we have a big trade deficit with China, $337 billion. That's more than half of our overall trade deficit, which isn't small. And so the idea that you can somehow reduce the trade deficit through an agreement like this, a one-time agreement, is a little bit misguided. It's really driven by macro factors.
So, but are you saying, though, that domestic political considerations swayed the day here? Because I know Trump's concerned about the farmers in the red states, which is where his support is, being upset. I mean, that was clearly a factor, right?
Absolutely. China has been pretty savvy in that their retaliatory tariffs have been aimed at agriculture. I think also if they're holding up goods at the border with increased inspections, I've just heard anecdotal stories that that is the case, then that would, of course, hit perishable goods first. So, you know, it would really be the agricultural sector who might be pinched first with all of these moves. And so to the degree that that is the administration space, sure, that could backfire on them quickly. But I think that the bigger issue is, you know, why are we thinking about the trade deficit? Because really this is driven by macro factors. Increasing deficit spending in the United States is actually, I mean, that by itself can increase our trade deficits with any country, including China. So it's a little bit strange to make that a focus of trade negotiations. Our objectives typically have been to achieve free and fair trade with other nations. That's why we've established a rules-based system with the WTO, the World Trade Organization, and through other types of regional trade agreements. So to have a negotiation process that's focused not on a rules-based system and getting adherence to rules, but instead trying to target transactional outcomes, like how big our trade deficit's going to be, which has more of the sense of a planned economy. That's just strange.
Well, but that was very much the campaign rhetoric coming from Donald Trump. And as you know, Catherine Russ, that he one of his big campaigns, planks of his campaign, was that the Chinese are taking us to the cleaners, that we have idiotic negotiators, and we need a really savvy businessman in there who's with the art of the deal, who can make a better deal. So what's going on here? It doesn't look to me like that Trump's making better deals. Maybe what's happening is he's getting a little bit educated about reality.
So I think trade is always the thing that presidential candidates love to hate, and then once they actually start governing, then it's, you know, they start to see how important trade is to the U.S. economy and also U.S. strategic relationships. So right now, for instance, we have all of these trade negotiations happening against the backdrop of potential negotiations with North Korea, to whom China is a really key ally. So it, well, I shouldn't say ally, but has a key relationship. So they're a key influencer of North Korea. So I think it is, as you say, complicated. It's more complicated than it seems at first. But the idea that you can somehow reduce a trade deficit with a trade agreement, it's about domestic policies. What really they need to be pushing China to do is continue rebalancing towards being a consumption-based economy. Right now, they're still kind of focused on investment. They've come a long way toward focusing more on consumption. But in the period when people talk about the China shock happening, China's investment was about 51% of GDP. So it was really high, higher than many other emerging markets, higher than the U.S. For sure. And so that investment means that you're really building up production capacity instead of putting money in consumers' pockets, basically. So one thing that they've done is to start expanding their social safety net. That makes it so that consumers don't have to save quite as much for precautionary reasons and can spend more. When consumers spend more, they often import more. So really rebalancing from an investment focus to a more consumption-based economy. The U.S. has a more consumption-based economy than China, for instance, so we import more than we export to them. These are the kinds of things that drive the overall trade deficit. It's not, you know, a trade agreement here, a trade agreement there. It's about macro policy. So if we really want to reduce a trade deficit with China, if that's actually a policy objective, then the way to do that would be to, one, try to rein in deficit spending here and try to encourage more consumer consumption power, consumption-led growth in China.
So can we say that the good news is that a trade war may not have necessarily been averted, but at least it's been postponed? But on the bad news side, I don't detect any movement on what appears to be a real issue, which Trump has brought up and Obama before him, and corporate America has certainly been talking about for some time, and that is how the Chinese end up grabbing American intellectual property as a price for doing business in China.
So to this end, the administration has also filed a WTO case. The WTO is the appropriate place to make these types of complaints. So if we feel that we have a case, then, you know, taking it to the WTO is where you can get redress for these kinds of issues. Some people have expressed concern over whether or not the WTO framework is strong enough when it comes to subsidies. So if it has rules that really let countries kind of go after unfair subsidies that may distort the pattern of trade. There's an issue between, I guess, I don't know if you want to call it North and South or emerging markets and advanced economies, but the countries who started the GATT, which became the World Trade Organization, they spent 50 years rolling back tariffs and really on manufactured goods in particular. So our tariffs on manufactured goods are quite low. It's hard for us to roll back tariffs on ag goods. So the TPP, for instance, made some steps toward doing that, toward freeing up more trade in the ag sector. But ag tends to be very sensitive in the U.S., in Europe, in Japan. So the problem we're left with is that as you get emerging markets coming into the WTO, so China ascended into the WTO in 2000, it's hard for advanced economies to really find something that gives them leverage or incentive for offer incentives for emerging markets to give up production subsidies. So some countries have thought it's very important to subsidize their industrial sectors in order to grow, to remove themselves from poverty. But then once they start entering the global economy and the WTO and so forth, you know, it's hard to figure out what to do. You know, are these subsidies distorting because, you know, China's not small anymore. It was maybe small, you could argue, in 2000, but now it's as big as the United States in terms of percentage of global GDP. So as Caroline Freund put it one time, she was talking about billionaire companies. So when kittens become cats, you know, what happens then? So what do we do then? And so I think that's really the issue. There are some economists, Chad Bown, Bob Stager, and Kyle Bagwell, who call this the latecomers problem. And the latecomers problem basically means emerging markets are big right now. I mean, they're growing. They're not small anymore. And that means that the United States isn't quite as big relative to the rest of the world as it used to be. So we need a multilateral forum like the WTO, like the OECD Global Forum on Steel, like the G20, to attack these problems. And right now what the United States is doing is crippling the WTO by not allowing different members to be appointed to its appellate body, by talking about retaliatory tariffs, which are completely outside the WTO framework. And we're also sort of sticking a finger in the eye of Europe periodically, who could really be an ally in this. So I think this veering off from a multilateral framework and relying totally on bilateral pressure to try to work out investment issues with China, that could really hurt us in the long run.
So when you talk about the emerging markets, though, are you talking about the BRICS group? Because they appear to be sort of ostracizing the United States.
So in particular, China. But, you know, there are other emerging markets, as you say, especially India in that group, Indonesia. Some countries are growing quite rapidly. Brazil was for a while. They fell into some difficulties during the commodity price dip, but it's
and South Africa is another one, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So we really need to be building our chips in a multilateral framework, whereas right now we seem to be spending them all.
So how do you feel about the current state of the economy and trade, in having been an economic advisor and senior economist for international trade and finance with the Obama White House? What's your sense of, because I recall the first thing that Donald Trump did was tear up the TPP, which was not just a trade agreement, but also a political effort to contain China in the sense of creating the rules of the road by which China would have to follow. And then by unilaterally tearing it up, all of the other TPP members have been trying to bring the U.S. back, particularly the Japanese. They almost did at one point. Trump indicated that he may reconsider pulling out of TPP, but then he reconsidered again. But in general, the impression that certainly I have is that for whatever flaws TPP had, the geopolitical importance of it would have outweighed what has subsequently happened with China becoming more of an authoritarian country. The possibility of the rule of law and liberalization has gone away under Xi Jinping. It seems like he's more emboldened. And rather than the United States and its partners setting the rules of the road for trade in the 21st century, China is able to go off on its own and attract other people into its rival organization.
Absolutely, Ian. I think you're absolutely right about this issue with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That the Trans-Pacific Partnership helps set, a rules-based system, so deepening the rules from the WTO to ensure free and fair trade. It also had enforceable labor standards to allow unions to grow, for instance, in Vietnam. So the first independent union could have been established in Vietnam because of TPP to prohibit illegal logging, and so with enforceable environmental standards and help keep our oceans clean, again, by making violations of certain environmental agreements subject to the trade dispute mechanism. So this kind of agreement would help us roll back some pressures that we would feel from China. It also had chapters on state-owned enterprises to treat them. So it defined market-based behavior and how that should look, and would make state-owned enterprises subject to similar laws as other countries other companies that would serve destination markets. So it really would have done a lot. It prohibited forced technology transfer, which is one of the main complaints of the administration right now. You see that with the 301 investigation from USTR. So you're absolutely right that TPP would have been a great way for us to help establish those rules of the road in the Asia-Pacific region. Thankfully, the 11 other countries that you mentioned have adopted it, and so those rules are still out there, and I think those rules will still have an influence. That we pulled out simply undermines how serious we are about pushing free and fair trade as opposed to just some kind of transactional outcome by focusing on the trade deficit.
But if Trump had not done what he did, pull out of the TPP, and with obviously Stephen Bannon being one of the big cheerleaders for doing that, and he's subsequently gone at any rate, where would we be today? It seems to me that had we stuck with TPP, we wouldn't be in this talking about a trade war with China.
So I think it would be harder for China to not take us seriously if we had joined the TPP. So being part of this huge economic bloc in the Asia Pacific with a lot of its neighbors certainly would make them take the United States more seriously as an influence in the region and as an important influence on trading rules in particular in the region. Right now, we've even set ourselves at odds with Japan in a way over trade issues, traditional ally. So with Japan, New Japan has said that they would like us, you know, to reconsider TPP, and they've really kind of pushed aside the idea of bilateral negotiations, which the administration has been advocating with Japan, instead of doing the whole group TPP with Japan in it, like those, so with all of those 11 countries at once. And Japan said, you know, no, we really want you to be a part of this regional agreement. And, you know, the steel and aluminum tariffs under the Section 232 move that the administration made, those do apply to Japan, and Japan has threatened retaliatory tariffs against those 232 tariffs on their steel coming into the United States. So we've basically set up a new skirmish with a traditional ally that we were about to enter into a huge new agreement with that would have allowed greater access for U.S. agriculture, for U.S. manufacturers, for U.S. services. So this is really a step backwards with Japan, and they're a major player in the region. So it would have certainly helped our influence with China had we maintained, you know, pretty strong unified stance with Japan.
Well, and just to finish up on TPP, can I make a case, as I've tried to suggest, that had TPP still been in place, and I remember at the time when reporting on it, when the negotiations were all sort of in secret and there was a sense that all the big corporations had a say, but the average person was shut out. There was a lot of critical reporting, a lot of which I put on the air. But subsequently, it seemed to me that keeping China on the path to more democracy, more openness, and more adherence to the rule of law was more important in retrospect. And now that Xi Jinping has turned the clock back and is jailing dissidents and curtailing the press and et cetera, there's no question he's turning back the clock. So I wonder, is there any, would TPP have somehow restrained Xi Jinping from going in the direction of more authoritarian rule?
So it's hard for me to speculate on President Xi Jinping's motives or how he might have responded to one policy or another. I can say that TPP definitely would have strengthened the U.S. hand in the Asia Pacific, and especially when it comes to trade negotiations, trying to confront unfair trade practices by state-owned enterprises. This TPP would have been very helpful to help set that precedent in the Asia Pacific. Some of those rules are still out there because the other 11 countries did adopt most of the provisions of TPP, but without the U.S. as part of it, it certainly undermines us as advocates of free and fair trade in the region. So I agree with you on that point.
Well, Catherine Ross, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Catherine Russ, who's a professor of economics at the University of California, Davis, who worked for the Obama administration's Council of Economic Advisors, a senior economist for international trade and finance. She's a faculty research associate in the National Bureau of Economic Research, International Trade and Investment Group, and a research advisor at the Halle Institute for Economic Research in Halle, Germany. And she's been a visiting scholar at the Central Banks of Germany, Portugal, and France, and the Federal Reserve Banks of St. Louis and San Francisco. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Lariva-Lutt. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.